If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Pete Tarrant is a digitized embroidery advocate, enthusiast, practitioner, and teacher whose work is good enough for the king. This is the second part of our needle exchange, and if you missed last week, then you need to go back and listen to how Pete came to be such an experienced digitized machine embroiderer and what it is like to do a piece of work for the coronation of the king. Not something that happens that often, let's face it. This is the second part of our needle exchange, and this time we sort of talk around the houses a bit. I get the opportunity to ask Pete lots of dumb questions about what it is like to do digitized machine embroidery. And in fairness, it is a very sort of much misunderstood technology from my standpoint. You know, when you have a sewing machine, you often think of dropping the feed dogs and possibly trying to bust out a bit of free machine embroidery. Whereas digitizing applies this whole new layer of science on the top of it, where you're able to virtually produce the design within a piece of computer software prior to actually executing a single stitch. It's much like building a room using computer-aided design. The kind of CAD software that Pete uses enables him to run an entire project from within the confines of a computer before ever putting needle to thread. And we talk all around it. We talk about the art of needlework. We talk about, you know, what the boundaries are when you try and take an artistic concept and embed it in reality using a needle and thread. And obviously, this is the second part of our exchange, so we cover Pete's cultural touch points. We find out an interesting fact about him as well, a little bit musical. And yeah, I think it's a great conversation. I'm honoured to have known Pete for a few years. I'm always impressed with his love of the craft and his enthusiasm for it. And there's never been a better time to get involved in this kind of thing. The cost of the technology continues to drop. The technology gets better. And if you thought that just making cool patches was the only thing you could do with digital embroidery, hey, it's true. You can make some really cool patches these days. But it's just the tip of the iceberg, honestly. So I would encourage you to follow Pete on social media. Links in the show notes. And indeed, if you do enjoy this work, please reach out to me via Instagram. Drop me an email. hello@needle.exchange with four E's. Four E's, of course. And let me know what you think of the show. If you've got any suggestions for guests, if you would like to be a guest on the show yourself, please do reach out and get in touch. It's always good. I'm having a blast doing these needle exchanges, so long may it continue. Anyway, enough of that. Enjoy the show. You're effectively creating a virtual version of all this. So were you able to specify the dimensions precisely for the RSN to do their bits? Are you the guy who's like making all this mathematically accurate as opposed to the artist who've come out with the idea in the first place?
Yeah. Well, I mean, basically, I got a full-size drawing of the actual tree, and then I have to plot where everything's going to go on it. I mean, on the registration, I managed to obviously put the actual names of all the leaves and everything on it as well. So that it was so, you know, I think for the girls, it was just like a dream that they just literally didn't have to even think about it. They had all, basically, they got all the hand stuff prepped, ready, so that when, obviously, when the tree turned up, they could just get on and start putting all the leaves and everything on it.
A little by painting by numbers almost. You're just going,
yeah,
that big,
isn't
it?
Yeah, yeah.
But then so, as you said, and I just wanted to check in with this, and when you do the registration, is that almost like a kind of outline of certain pieces in certain places, which, as you then said, also stabilizes the surface a bit for you or holds things together?
Yeah, totally. I mean, like I said, having an applique that big, having that registration on there actually pulled all the fabric down so it didn't move or, you know, roll or anything. We didn't get any puckering in it at all. It was just really nice. It hung really well. The border went on it like, I mean, the best applique border I've ever done in my life. So it was just really nice to, you know, yeah, I mean, the whole project, it was really stressful, but the actual running off was just, you know, immense, watching the tree grow, because the actual physical trunk itself, you know, looks like it's actually a tree, basically, which is really cool.
And if you, as the trunk is all machine stitched as well, you're directing all of those stitches, creating the bark like effects and all those kind of things.
Yeah. Yeah, everything from start to finish on, you know, the tree, the leaves, is all stuff that, you know, we had to do. We spent a lot of time sampling to get the textures right. And obviously the colouring was chosen by Aidan Hart. And the stuff he does is phenomenal. He, you know, he works with like 12th century drawings and all sorts. So he, you know, first of all, when I first saw the colouring, I was like thinking, this doesn't look like it's going to work. But once we'd put it all together, it was just amazing. You know, some of the stuff, you just think, wow, this man knows his stuff. I think the whole project, it was really nice to work with people who are at the top of their game. Mm-hmm. You know, the guy that made the eagles that went on top of the posts, Tim Royal, amazing sculptures. And also Nick Grunfall, he did all the woodwork, and what an amazing carpenter, King's Carpenter. He's fantastic. He was the project manager of the whole thing as well. So,
right.
And then obviously Anne Butcher and Gemma at the Royal School of Needlework. I mean, they're just amazing. Everyone at that place is amazing. So, you know, I always bow down to their amazing work. It's, you know, it doesn't come half as a patch as, you know, what I do. Their stuff is like just off the chart. So,
I mean, it is, but I think you do yourself a disservice there. And I think that one of the things I admire about you and I admire about these kind of projects is that you are showing people what's possible with effectively what seems like domestic technology. You know, it's fascinating to me, and I want to come on to it about how sort of little people think of digitized embroidery. Maybe that's a bit fair. You know, they think patchmaking sometimes, and you do get people who elevate the status, but it's certainly quite a misunderstood art form, would you say?
Oh, totally. I mean, because the one thing with the anointing screen was it was funded by the Livery Companies of London. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if you're aware of, obviously, what they do, but I would like to try and get digital embroidery as a livery that we can get and hopefully get funding for different projects on that side of things. So that would be the ultimate for me, is to, you know, to have it as a, like you say, as an art form, which it is. I mean, it is an art form, to try and get people, you know, more people involved in it, basically. Obviously, because where I teach as well, because I teach at fashion and textile universities around the country. And that for me as well is like the icing on the cake. But with a lot of stuff that's been going on with Brexit and stuff like that, you know, the funding side seems to be getting less and less for them, which is very frustrating in a way. So, I mean, it's very difficult out there at the moment, I think, for universities and stuff to get the funding. But I would love to get, you know, more people involved in digital embroidery and have it as a as an art form. So yeah,
does it tend to form more within the realms of it being a technology, you know, a bit like printmaking, a bit like surface design? Is that how a lot of people's gateway into using digitized stuff comes now?
Not really. I think the problem is a lot of people don't realize what, you know, how much it is used in various areas of you know, but our clothing. I mean, obviously I'm more fortunate because I'm working in with people doing completely off the cuff stuff, so which makes it very interesting. You know, on a day-to-day basis, if you're just doing corporate wear, then, you know, you're doing school wear and jumpers and same old stuff. But, you know, for me, it's always, you know, I'm quite fortunate because I'm at a position where I get offered jobs that I can pick and choose. And if I think they're worthy of doing something with, then it makes it fun, which is, you know, I love doing what I do.
You're like the Robert Downey Jr. of the embroidery world. I'm going to let you have that as a quote now or something. Once you've worked for the king, I mean, you know, you can just pick and choose your offers in there.
Well, no, it was before that, really. But it's just nice to be able to. I mean, I love to help a lot of students that are coming through that are doing stuff. I'm trying to get machine and software package sorted so that it's affordable for students. That's my main aim at the moment, because I want to try and get, you know, more kids involved in this. I mean, there is a lot of talk about primary schools getting back into textiles as well, which is great. I don't know, I've had contacts from several primary schools locally that are interested in, you know, doing some sort of embroidery textile program, which I don't know how much of that is going to go on, but it would be great to see if it does progress any further. And the, a lot of the universities as well, it's it'd be nice to see more going on like that. I mean, it'd be nice to have a complete embroidery class in universities that would encompass everything, you know, cross stitch, hand stitch, digital. I think that would be my ultimate dream if I won the lottery, would be to create an embroidery university. Would be fantastic.
We'll start that now. Just, you heard it here first. That's what we'll end up doing when we're both millionaires. Suppose it's interesting because because it seems to be quite a leaning for like STEM, doesn't there? Science, technology, is it English and maths? I don't know. Because yours is like bound in science, isn't it? It's almost like you've got a foot in the door in some ways that some of the more ephemeral types of needlework don't have, because it is technology driven, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, it's you know, working with, I work quite closely with one of the machine manufacturers, ZSK, which are German. And I think they're the only ones that are really pushing the boundaries even more, because they're doing stuff, what we call technical embroidery, which is using carbon fiber thread with resin on it. So they're stitching stuff out and then it's being pressed. So they're making car parts, all sorts of stuff with this stuff. And that means they can go, it's almost like a 3D printer, but embroidered. So it means they can go back into the actual, you know, they can test out stuff on cars, and if it's not strong enough, they can go back in and reweave the carbon fiber in the software and reprint it, you know, or re-embroider it. So, I mean, it's fascinating, all of it. You know, a lot of the stuff that I get involved in is just blows my head away sometimes. So
yeah, I think you just blown my mind a little bit there, to be honest, as well. That's quite something. If you were, like, imagine somebody's never really heard of digitized embroidery, how do you best describe it to people in relative layman terms?
I always describe it as a vector-based software, and generally I try and have you ever used Adobe or, you know, Photoshop or Illustrator. Generally, most people have at some time in their life had a play with either Photoshop or Illustrator, so they've got a rough idea how it works. And then I just tend to say to them, you know, with Illustrator, you just, instead of the colors, you've got a selection of stitches you can apply to it. So, which is, you know, in some respects, it's very simple. You can apply the stitches to the actual vector lines, but then you've got to put it onto fabric, which is then the difficult part. As we well know, every bit of fabric is different. So you've then got to get it to work on the fabrics you're putting it on, which is the skill in itself, is being able to create the design that's going to work on that fabric.
And that's even when it's just a flat design, but you can get kind of structural with the stuff you're doing, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's just so much involved in it. I mean, I'm still learning it, and I've been doing it as long as I have. So, which is why I love working with the students, because I just learn so much from them as they learn from me. So, yeah, it's a good position to be in. It's nice.
And what are some of the key takeaways you get, like, or some of the bits of wisdom that you find yourself sharing with students more often than not? Because there's got to be some, like, real smart pearls to be delivered.
I think generally with students, you sort of give them the tools and they just go off in their own little, you know, and then generally, generally most of the classes that I teach, I give them the tools and then they go off in their own little world. And then I generally walk around and have a look and see what they're doing, and then just ask them questions about what they're going to do, how they're going to do it, what you want to put it on, what's your intention, how, you know. And also as well, the most important thing is the carbon footprint of it, is what, you know, especially with fashion, is, you know, I know you want to do this, but what is the carbon footprint of what you're going to do? I think it's a very important question. So, yeah, I mean, it's always different, Jamie. It's really difficult. It's a difficult question to sort of answer, really, because it's so broad. With everything you do, there's just so much stuff you can do with it. There's no sort of one thing that I try and show them as much of the content of the software as possible without sort of trying to blow their heads away, because otherwise they just get, you know, stuck in just doing little bits. So I just give them little teasers and then open it up from there, really.
And do you think, like, really, like you say, for them to just, it's kind of going, here's a toolkit, just go and make stuff, and just allow them to explore and push at the boundaries and almost kind of break it? Because I guess if a lot of the, you can do a lot of the stuff virtually, this is what you were saying. So in some ways, I suppose they don't actually have to physically make the things when they're in that experimental phase. They can kind of break them virtually.
Well, the only problem is, obviously, with doing it virtually is you can't see how it's going to pull on the fabric.
Right.
Because it just gives you the running, how it's going to run. So you still have that, I guess with a lot of students, they tend to do stuff and it might have a lot of density in it, for example. So therefore, you know, you end up with a broken needle because it's so close together, it can't physically stitch it. So, you know, there's a lot of knowledge that needs to go into knowing what you're doing with certain things and knowing what the basics of the software can or can't do. And yeah, I mean, there's boundaries with all of it. And I think the boundaries are there to be pushed, which there are with everything. But obviously you've still got limitations because you're using a needle and a thread. So, you know, whichever way we look at it, you've always got to remember how thick a needle is and how thin thread is. So that is your limitation, basically, you know, and the size of the bed you're going to use. You know, once you know those limitations, then you can do whatever you want with the software. So, yeah.
Is there a process people go through when they break needles? How many needles do you have to break before you can be at peace with the fact that it's a necessary evil?
It depends. I mean, obviously, needles generally will break on, depending on what fabrics you're doing. I mean, with, for example, where I'm working on interior, we're going through three layers of wadding and, you know, we've got a very thick top layer to it. So, and you have a very tensile thread, which is quite strong. So the tensions on it are a lot higher than you would use on normal fabrics. So you have a tendency to have a lot of broken needles, but it's about getting you know, getting your tools to that perfection where you know exactly how far you can push them. And I think most of the time I try and get most of the densities to a point where, you know how far you can push the density before you know you're going to get a broken needle. And to be honest, with the interior, we get very few broken needles with their occasional broken needles, but because we've got it to a point where, like I said, it's taken a long time to get it there, but we've got it to a point where we we know exactly how far we can push it. So
it sounds a bit almost like blacksmithing or something. You know, you have to put in a good 5,000 hours of thumping before instinctively you can kind of work out where your points are. Do you adjust the speed of the stitching? Is that something like when you're doing, say you're doing an anointing screen, are you stitching more slowly than the average, or is it still the same thing? Do you have to adjust the pace for different types of surfaces to make sure that you get the precision?
Not generally, no. Generally, you can the machine will run at the speed given you want to run it at, but generally, if you want to, I mean, we were using a new thread, so I didn't really know how far I could push it. So it was a case of, we did run it a lot slower, just to see how it would work. But obviously now I know, probably not the best thing to be learning on. We managed to get it to a point where it was working really nicely, to be honest with you. It you know, and it's super nice thread, so...
With your average everyday amateur, I know a lot of sewing machines these days do have programmable levels. Is that a good way for people to wrap their head around this stuff? Would you say to someone, if they were interested in the first place, that there are some pretty reasonable, you can go and buy in Hobbycraft kind of machines they can try out?
Yeah, I mean, basically the entry level, which I used to work with Brother quite a lot, which is the Brother machine, the PR series. PR is, I'd say, is definitely the, you know, is a good starter point because it's built for people that don't really know what they're doing. So it's got loads of sensors on it that stops you from hitting the frame and stitching yourself to the, through the needle. So I think in that respect, that is probably a good starting point. There's lots of companies that do... that sell them. In my book, I think Stock Sewing Machines, they do a good install and you get a day's training with them, which is fantastic. So,
and it's just a great way for people to start to personalize things, right? You know, I always think that's
probably one of the fun bits about it. Yeah, I mean, it's got a font basis on it, which is not the best in the world, but it's great. A lot of pop-up people use them for events and stuff because they're lightweight as well. So yeah, I mean, you know, they're a good little machine.
Cool. So you've done the work for the King. I really like that Hackney Dave piece. I wondered whether there are any other projects that spring to mind as ones that you're particularly proud of.
I think we did one for the Arts Council, which was Struggle Within. It was for which was 4 meters by 4 meters, and we did all sequin lettering all around the outside, which was really nice. That again is on my Insta. That was a really cool piece to work on. I mean, they're all the stuff we do is pretty good as well. It's just one job to another. There's no like particular. It's just doing it and, you know, being involved in the moment. I just love doing all the stuff anyway. So it's that start and finish and, you know, here it is sort of scenario all the time where we, you know, you go through the process and then you end up with this sparkly gold coin at the end of it. So yeah, it's really nice. I think it's really nice to have the process for me. You know, being very dyslexic as well and probably ADHD, it's the one thing that keeps me on the straight and narrow. So
that's quite interesting because, yeah, you said that like this stuff makes your brain feel normal. And actually, working with the software and working with the vector design, I guess it's quite a visual thing. So maybe that doesn't, isn't impacted by the dyslexia in the same way. I don't know.
No, I don't. Well, exactly. I don't really know, but it's, you tend to find a lot of, especially teaching in fashion and textiles, there's a lot of dyslexic people are within that industry.
Right.
So I don't know whether it's something that, you know, draws, you know, well, I call it my superpower anyway. So, you know, it's one of those things that you have to sort of deal with and live with through your life, you know, and I've just always applied myself to this and it seems to have worked. So,
and then, so as well as making amazing work and then being a teacher and a lecturer, you also judge competitions as well, hand and lock competition. I was wondering whether there are any like real standout digitizing artists that spring to mind, or people, you know, because I know, you know, I'm a hand and lock judge as well, and it's really exciting where you can look through the different work and then every now and again you come across someone who just blows your socks off because they're just so like, whoa. And I just wonder who, if there are any whoa people that spring to mind for you.
I mean, there's a couple of people that that I sort of follow on Instagram, which is like Jenny King, who does a lot of stuff with Irish embroidery, and I think her work is outstanding. And there's just so much stuff out there that is so outstanding. It just, you know, everything blows me away most of the time because I'm just like, wow, have they done that? You know, and I want to try and pick through it and see what they've done with it. So, I mean, there's I'm just trying to think off the top of my head. David Moorish from Kingfly. He's another one that's, you know, it's nice to have some males as well involved in this, which is very far and few between.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. If I thought mine was niche and it's like, I don't know, half the world does cross it, yours is like the nichiest niche, isn't it?
Yeah. And Twain as well, Twain Creative, who does a lot of costume stuff. I mean, his stuff is, you know, he's doing 16th century outfits, which are just completely off the chart. You know, the quality of the work that he does is phenomenal. And it's been nice sort of working and teaching with, you know, teaching him and helping him with various things when he's got questions. The same with David, you know. I think I'm on speed dial to a lot of people.
You're like the Mr. Miyagi.
With the software. Yeah, which is really nice, you know. It's really nice to be wanted sometimes. So, yeah.
That's so good. It's so good. It's interesting because I think that, you know, Instagram and social media did a lot to push forward people's understandings and inspiration of needlework. But I think never more is it better served than in the realm that you're talking about, because people need to see it to believe it. And then when they do see it, like I think it's probably one of the most transformative things you can see is really well executed digitized embroidery, because it just blows your preconceptions away. Because I think people, they don't even have preconceptions, they don't really think about it. And then to show them it's so much more than you even thought it was.
Yeah. It's
very exciting times, I would have thought.
Yeah, it is. I mean, obviously, as it's a technology based as well, then obviously, because I work quite closely with Wilcom, it's just really, it's nice to be able to apply ideas and stuff. Obviously, students come back with ideas like, oh, why can't we do this? So it's always nice to have that close relationship with Wilcom that I can badger them to death till they get things done. So, yeah, there's lots of stuff happening with the software at the moment, which is quite exciting. So I'm looking forward to the next chapter with it. So, yeah. And I feel, I just seem to remember, Jamie, at some point you were going to come and spend a day with me.
Yes. And that's not to say that I don't want to do that, believe
no,
me.
No, I know you're a busy boy.
Well, I think the laws of time and space and parenthood, those are the three things. If I could lose one or any of those laws, I'd have half a chance, I tell you. But I mean, I think I'm coming down to London in November for the Hand and Lock Awards. Yeah. So that'll get me out of Cheshire for the first time this year. I swear to God, it's ridiculous. But it's just time flies. I'd love to like come and have a play. I did, I mean, years ago, I think Husqvarna gave me a machine that I was able to do a little bit of stuff with. But again, just not having the time to really dig under the surface. I'm sort of realizing that I have lots of ideas of things that can be done, but don't necessarily have the time to execute those ideas. So maybe I just need to get some underlings or something. But, you know, I just think it's great the fact that you're able to connect with a lot of these students. You know, they're very much the next phase of all this, aren't they? And it, in the same way as they're digitally native, it's almost like they're sort of digitized embroidery native as well. You know, it's not an unfamiliar technology, and it'd be interesting.
Yeah, totally.
And I love the idea of that, like the resin thing or using conductive thread and suddenly putting this other like wearable tech layer through the whole thing as well. Like that's, we'll have to have a summit on that. I'm going to move on to some other tough questions now, if I may. I know we've already given this some thought, so I'm just going to go with, do you have a favourite band / album?
Yes, would be Japan, Quiet Life. I think it was called Quiet Life. I'm not very good at remembering the wording, and I can see the picture of it, which is always the best way I used to remember stuff. So, they were an 80s, I guess, glam rock type new romantic band at the time.
Yeah.
So, and I think Duran Duran sort of took a lot of inspiration from them as well. So they were, you know, and I think the Steve Jansen, the drummer, was always one of my, because every song they produced was, you know, just had this fantastic rhythm on it. So, and the songs were fantastic. So, yeah, I think I followed them and saw them about 5-6 times, I think, throughout the years. And yeah.
Were you quite a new romantic kid?
Well, I went from punk to new romantic. So I sort of was transitioned from that to that. So, because it was just the natural thing to do at that time, I think. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. Did New Wave come in that? No, New Wave was, that was more leaning electronically, wasn't it? I suppose new romantic.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it was new romantic, electronic. I think they were all much a muchness, to be honest with you.
So, I had a similar thing that would have been when I went to uni. So this was like 94, where up until going to uni, I'd spent a long time just being into heavy metal, like Guns N' Roses, Iron Maiden, Metallica, all of those bands that were having their halcyon day. And then when I went to uni, someone introduced me to like acid jazz. And I feel like that was another one of those, you know, you're just like, oh, well, that's utterly different from what I'm doing. And now I'm listening to like Galliano and Jamiroquai.
I mean, you know, although I say punk, you know, mine was also metal, because it was Rush, Black Sabbath, White Snake, all the classic,
the new wave of British heavy metal, as they called it, right?
Which was just, you know, fantastic, really. And obviously the punk side on top of that, which was, you know, Stranglers, X-Ray Specs, Billy Idol, and that sort of stuff, you know. So, and then it sort of progressed to, you know, Boy George and all that side of things, which is quite weird, really, you know.
I'm still sensing there's like a costume embroidery theme through a lot of this, though, isn't there? Whether it's like punk patches or Boy George and all that.
Yeah.
It was obviously within you, just like you just knew all these things were kind of coming together. Have you ever done any stuff with like bands?
I mean, obviously I've played in quite a few bands, but my brother, who is one of my heroes because of the he writes music and he's a full-time musician. The stuff he does is fantastic. He does a lot of theatre and a lot of stuff. So he does a lot of costume and he does a lot of crochet as well. So he crochets he crocheted beards and eyebrows and moustaches for his band, which was absolutely off the chart. It was just absolutely brilliant. So yeah, if you want to check them out, they're called Ooballoon.
Right.
Which is like, as in Uber and then Loon, LOON.
Okay.
But yeah, they're you know, a fantastic band, and the stuff they do and the stuff my brother writes is just so good. So,
and what about your bands? I'm not sure if I know much about your musical side. What do you play?
Well, I'm a drummer and percussionist. So, I came through the whole vinyl DJ scenario. Played in bands up until probably I was about 25, and then got fed up with egotistical front men and started playing percussion at raves, basically. And then got into vinyl and DJing and started playing bongos and DJing at raves and spent nearly 20 years doing it. So
that's where the nickname comes from.
Took me to Ibiza, to Las Vegas, Australia, all over the place, really, you know, Europe, in the underground scene. So yeah, it was fun times, very fun times. And I did illegal woods parties for 20 years, so which was very good fun.
Allegedly, just in case allegedly, you can get arrested for that sort of thing. That's amazing. Are the bongos like one of the secret weapons of the musical scene, do you think?
It always was the party scene. It was always one of those things that always seemed to get people up on the dance floor dancing. So, or the Pied Piper, as sometimes people used to call me. So
awesome. Awesome.
So, yeah.
Favorite book?
Obviously, being very dyslexic, I struggled reading for a lot of the time, and probably about 3 years ago discovered audiobooks, which suddenly brought me into that. I can talk to people about books, which I've never been able to do before. So one of the first books that I read was a book by Dr. Michael Greger called How Not to Die. And it's an absolutely fascinating book about nutrition, what plants can cure you and what other stuff can or can't do stuff to you, and cure blood pressure and other stuff that we have in, you know, the common eating things that we have in our diet. So
that's an interesting one, in as much as I was just thinking, like, you sort of, with dyslexia and not necessarily wanting to read books, I'm automatically thinking about fiction books, but that's very short-sighted of me, because yeah, you're quite right, it would put you off reading a lot of non-fiction books as well. So that's kind of, because you're vegan, right?
Yeah.
And how long have you been vegan?
10 years.
Right. And what prompted that?
Firstly, health. At the time, I've had IBS all my life, so it was something that I'd sort of tinkered with and then tried. And then a friend of mine who's been vegan for 30 odd years sort of helped me and said, right, this is what, you know, I'll give you information and we'll get it sorted out. So I just took the plunge on one Veganuary and absolutely transforms everything, really, you know, my health, my focus, everything. So it's been the best thing I ever did.
That's so good. Do you listen to like podcasts and stuff when you're working? Do you listen to music when you're working?
Bit of both, really. I listen to some podcasts, and I've been listening to yours quite a lot, actually, for the last three or four months, which has been really good, actually. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, actually. I do listen to, and I like to listen to book. I mean, for the first time, like I say, it's been really nice to just be able to download a book and listen to it, which, you know, and obviously traveling quite a lot as well. That's always one thing I always have on, is a book and listen to it. It's fascinating, from, you know, Ramanish Ranganathan's biog, which was absolutely hilarious, to all sorts, really. Just anything that sort of, I've just downloaded the, I can't remember what the guy's name is, an SAS guy, which was, because I listened to the Chris Evans show in the morning, he has loads of different guests on, and this guy was like quite fascinating. So I downloaded his book and listened to it, and that's quite fascinating. So yeah, I mean, all sorts, Jamie, to be honest with you. It's just, you know, cooking stuff, because I cook all the time, so I'm always downloading cooking books and stuff like that as well. So yeah.
So my wife, we just got Mira Soda's new book, because she does a vegan column in The Guardian, and it's called Dinner, right. And there's some really nice dishes in that. I just wondered who your favorite like vegan veggie cooks are.
Well, he's not a hundred. I mean, the Bosch brothers do a lot of stuff, so they've got a book out, you know, because they do a lot of stuff for the supermarket as well. But I would probably say he's not 100% vegan, plant-based. Is probably Otto Lange, because I've got one of his books at the moment called Flavor.
Right.
Which is, it's a fascinating book. It shows you how to cook different, you know, you can cook an aubergine in six different ways and get six different flavors out of it. And it's just really fascinating, some of the stuff you can get from that, which is really cool. So
do recipe books, do they mess with your dyslexia? Do like all books do it, or there are certain forms of presentation that are easier?
What I tend to do is, obviously with technology now, you can obviously highlight it with your phone and then get it to read it out to you. So that's generally what I try and do with some stuff if I struggle with it. So
just give it some weird spice names and see if it can handle it, just for fun, stuff like that. Favorite film?
Favorite film? God.
I know what you said to me was your favorite film, which is highly disturbing.
Yeah, Nightmare on Elm Street, which was the very first film that scared the absolute living daylights out of me. It was like one of those films that, you know, I don't think I slept for 2 weeks after.
Yeah, it's 100% the point, wasn't it? It's like, I'm not going to go to sleep now.
But then you look back at it and think, you know, I just thought it was really well put together from the normal sort of horror stuff that you know, of the time, I think. So, yeah, I mean, but there's so many different films. It's difficult to sort of, I think the Alien series is really good. I mean, there's Stranger Things on Netflix. That was amazing as well. So, you know.
You seem to like to dwell in the darkness with this stuff.
Oh, always, yeah, always.
Not The Sound of Music or anything like that. I always remember the, because in the first Nightmare on Elm Street, Johnny Depp's isn't it? It's one of his first films. And there's that whole bit where he gets like sucked into the bed and then projected outwards. And I remember seeing like a behind the scenes of how they kind of did that upside down and just dumped all this water out on the floor. But because they filmed it the wrong way around, it sort of vomits out onto the ceiling and stuff. Wow. Wasn't it? It was just like, yeah, oh, that's my right, God. Yeah. It was such a big deal when I was a kid as well. Freddy Krueger is unbelievable, really.
Yeah, I know. It was just one of those that I think it was the first sort of horror that you could be real, almost, because it was like mind orientated. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah, I might have to rewatch it. I mean, it might not have aged well from a tech standpoint or something, you know. But at the same time, a good scary film still. Do you still watch horror films then?
Not generally, no. I mean, I do occasionally, but now I tend to watch, I like thrillers and Marvel, because obviously, I think the comics for me when I was a kid was the one thing that I could actually look at without having to read too much.
Yeah, I was going to ask that.
So, you know, Iron Man and Spider-Man were my, you know, sort of ultimates, I guess. So, yeah.
Have you got a favourite superhero then?
I would probably close call Iron Man or Spider Man. They're probably on the same par, but yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, because I've read comics. I don't know, since I was about 8 or whatever. But I think I always leaned in like the mutant. I was like X Men kind of direction.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Whereas, I know that who's got the best powers, which isn't who my favorite superhero is. Sorry to anybody who's listening now, you can tune out now. But I know for a fact that the Invisible Woman in the Fantastic Four has got the best powers, because she's got invisibility, but she's also got force fields. And with force fields, you can like kind of like lift whatever you want, effectively fly. You can do all this kind
and
of stuff.
Disappear.
So to me, and disappear, you know. So she's got like the best defensive power set in the sector. So if I had to have a power, it would be that one. But most of my powers are just ironic. Now, and then, is there an interesting fact that not a lot of people know about you?
Well, I guess I think a lot of people don't know that I'm quite involved in music, with drumming and stuff like that. So I guess that side of it is probably.
And is that still an active thing then? You're still actively drumming?
Yeah. I mean, I've the band I play for at the moment, we rehearse once a week. We're playing next week at the Good Mixer in Camden, if you fancy a laugh.
Very good. What's your genre?
Rock. So it's sort of soft rock, I guess, sort of bordering Coldplay-ish type rock. I don't really know. My mum always used to say, I'm just the drummer.
Yeah, I just hit the skins, mate. I'm not really paying attention. Just let me know when it's finished. Just play anything. Who's your favourite drummer? Do you have any drumming heroes?
Yeah, I do have a few. Obviously, Steve Jansen from Japan was one of them. Omar Hakim, he was Sting's drummer when he toured. An amazing acid jazz drummer. Mark Berezielki, who used to play for Big Country.
Okay.
Who I've met a couple of times. I went on some of his, because they used to do these like Pearl drum school things, and you could go and have an audience with certain drummers, and he was one of the ones that stood out the most out of some of the ones I went to. So there's, I mean, there's so many.
What is it that makes a good drummer from your standpoint?
Listening. Lots of drummers that play don't really listen. I think sometimes they don't listen to what's going on around them. And I think being a drummer, you need to be listening to everything that's going on, especially the bass player. Or the bass player needs to be listening to you. You need to be working in harmony. So that's always that groove, I think, is the, you know.
And it's because the drummers, isn't the drummer kind of responsible for the pace of things? Or do you, are you saying a good drummer?
I mean, we are. Yeah, we are the most important person in the band. As I'm always telling our singer.
He refuses to listen. What do you think about people like, is it like Anderson .Paak and even maybe to some extent Chris Martin, who can drum and sing at the same time? That always seems to blow my mind a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I've always done some of the bands I've played in. I've always done backing vocals and stuff as well. So with headset on, which makes it easier. So, yeah.
My air drumming can't extend that far, particularly not if I'm, I mean, I think, to be honest, I always think when I was a kid growing up, I had a bass guitar and then my best mate got a bass guitar. And so I never really learned to play it because like we just never, there were two of us doing it. It just all fell apart. But upon reflection, I think I should have learned to play the drums because I seem to spend a lot of time doing air drumming, particularly when I'm driving and stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether at the age that I'm heading towards, whether it's too late to pick up a musical instrument.
It's never too late, Jamie. Never.
Never too late. Never. I'll just start with a couple of chopsticks on the dining table and go from there.
Really. Well, there's a start, yeah.
There is a start. Hey, Pete, thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
Well, thanks for having me, Jamie.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NEEDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.